the expansion of this type of activity as the only possible way of keeping tyranny from completely enslaving entire social groups. And at this time, we know of several rather despotic leaders who are in constant and mortal fear and terror, surrounding themselves with the most exaggerated methods of personal defense because of their fear of private assembly within their own regions, and also their knowledge that this exists and their inability to ferret it out. One of the reasons they cannot discover these groups is because these groups are protected by the people in general. The people may not have the courage to belong to them or to advance secret causes against prevailing pressures, but they are sympathetic to these groups, therefore cannot be induced to reveal them, and will usually simply decline to discuss it or insist that, as far as they know, such assembly does not exist. It was private assembly which liberated Latin America not more than 100 years ago. It was private assembly that resulted in the gradual rise of the rights of people throughout Europe 150, 200 years ago. It was private assembly that strongly advanced the cause of our own Revolutionary War. It was private assembly that created the Republic of China in 1912. It was private assembly that advanced the freedom of most of the Far Eastern nations that finally achieved constitutional government. This secret assembly must therefore continue, inasmuch as the need for it also continues. In our particular modern situation, we realize that there are large areas of the world today in which the ethical, spiritual, and moral needs of mankind are relatively ignored, where attitudes and processes are forced upon persons whose natures do not conform with such pressures. There has been a considerable enslaving of intellectuals. There has been a powerful trend against the rights of the individual to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And we may say that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, these words, this statement, was once the secret statement of a secret society. This statement moved Europe nearly 200 years ago and brought about the tremendous change, which was a powerful social advance for mankind. We know, therefore, that today, behind barriers, wherever tyranny exists, there is a constant and desperate determination to resist. That these resistant movements arose in World War II, in the form of the famous underground movements. These movements certainly were not religious, primarily, although the concept of religion moved with them. They were not essentially philosophical, yet they demanded obligations, and they tried and tested those who sought to join them. And these testings and trials were for the same purposes as ancient rites, namely, to prove that the candidate could be entrusted with responsibility of knowledge, knowledge which, if misused, might destroy the other members of a fraternity. This type of thinking is going on strongly today. It is probably active in two-thirds of the world, and it is active toward ends which we here in America regard as highly desirable ends. Ends leading to universal tolerance, universal education, universal opportunity, universal liberty. These are the essential principles of the modern secret society. Such societies also, of course, exist on purely specialized levels, as your educational societies, your Greek letter societies, and things of that nature. These are usually honor societies toward which the individual aspires in order that he may prove his unusual proficiency or advancement in some subject. But even today, most of these honor societies in areas outside of our own are bound into the general picture. And this general picture has become considerably confused in the last 25 or 30 years. During most of the 19th century, secret societies that had brought peoples to various degrees of security have moved and created from themselves leaders, for most leadership was backed by some pressure. Had it not been so backed, it could not have moved forward against an entrenched tyranny. These leaders were individuals, apparently, but had they not received help of some kind, usually secret help, they would not have been able to survive to achieve the reformations which they accomplished. But during the 19th century, most of this pressure let down. It looked as though the world was moving forward, inevitably and magnificently, toward a better state of things. It is true that there were wars, there were troubles in those days, but these troubles were comparatively isolated, one arising here, one arising there. And most of these troublous situations were envisioned as means of accomplishing a further advancement of man by removing some obstacle to that advancement, or by binding divided and discordant groups into some larger and more comprehensive pattern. The general trend, therefore, was for the secret society to move into fields essentially less vital than that of an earlier date. We find them, therefore, strongly advancing on the levels of trade unions and guilds. We find the rise of various movements intended to improve and protect various crafts and arts. We also find the rise of benevolent and fraternal orders, or the gradual transformation of earlier societies into these specializations. The Hung Society in China, for example, after it had achieved the democracy, turned to labor situations and the internal protection and advancement of its underprivileged classes. There was a respite. And the individuals believed that the great work had been accomplished, that man would never again fall under the kind of tyranny from which it had emerged in the long and difficult period from the Dark Ages. In the last 25 years, the situation has been almost completely reversed. Today, tyranny looms large. The rights of man have been undermined in numerous areas. Most of all, materialism is rampant among groups on the ground that it is only by the extinction of ideals that slavery can be perpetuated. Materialism leads inevitably toward the acceptance of slavery. It removes from the individual his vision of greater spiritual value, and in this way takes away from him his basic impulse to defend and protect such value at all cost. So we have today a world which perhaps is not much better off in total than it was 500 years ago. It knows more, it is richer, and in some areas, such as the Western Hemisphere, its progress continues at a reasonable rate. But for the rest of the world, life is closing in, and has closed in for a number of years. It has reduced its boundaries to medieval fortresses. It has divided its projects and purposes, and under the general name and term of mechanistic progress, it has lost sight of most of the values that are real and dear to the private citizen. The family is attacked. The home is attacked. The right of private assembly is attacked. The privilege of free vote is attacked. The right to worship, to have convictions, is either attacked or ridiculed. And by degrees, the private citizen is reduced to the state in which the need for private assembly is strongly reemphasized. As a result of this condition, such private assembly is rising throughout these areas. Private assembly, in some instances, for private worship. And there are countries today where worship is not very different from the way it was in the catacombs under Rome during the time of the pagan Caesars. It is necessary to meet secretly in cellar and attic and to watch constantly for a traitor in your midst. It is hard for us to imagine that such things can exist today. But there are actually secret societies that have been created in certain parts of Eastern Europe for one purpose only, the circulation among the members of a Western newspaper. Something which could and might very likely cause the most terrible penalty if any one of that little circle should betray the others. It is a little hard for us to imagine all this, but it is true. Now, your secret society, moving into a situation, moves in with a tremendous traditional background. All through Eastern Europe, secret societies existed from before the beginning of the Christian era. These secret societies had long and illustrious histories of fighting for the right of these peoples to exist, to overcome the restrictions and limitations of arbitrary aristocracies. These secret societies struggled for freedom from serfdom, the establishment of citizenship, the right to possess property, the right to educate children, the right to pray, the right to read and write. These things were fought for with every ounce of courage that human beings possessed. There were numerous martyrs toward these ends, and some very hideous and horrible things happened beyond almost the imagination of modern man. He cannot see how anyone could so persecute another for such reasonable and commendable objectives. These societies were and still are known to the peoples of these countries. They are part of the tradition of these peoples, like the famous Bogomils of the Balkans and other groups, constantly struggling until they attained a measure of achievement and made possible the glimpse of a better way of life. Then came an opening of Europe. Opportunity, travel, brought visitors. Education increased. Schools sprang up everywhere. Freedom of culture began to be enjoyed. In some cases, comparatively moderate, but at the same time, far in excess of that which previously existed. Then all of a sudden, with two great world wars, this progress was stopped in its tracks. Things began to go back to the medieval, to the incredibly limited and restricted. and the natural tendency of all these peoples was to fall back upon tradition, upon the traditional struggle of their great and venerated heroes to achieve these ends which men knew were right. Thus, societies that had either been extinct for several hundred years were brought back to life, or those which had changed their purposes to more benevolent or fraternal ends were rededicated to their original projects. And out of the general situation has risen a network of secret societies. These, many of them, with strong political purposes, because there seems to be no other way of breaking through the tyranny that now oppresses them. Most of these societies are created out of groups of so-called ordinary citizens. Sometimes from such a group will arise, as has occurred in the past, a brilliant leader. But because these societies are built from the people and not from the so-called oligarchy or leading group, these societies are for the most part not only patriotic but religious. They represent, again, the demand for spiritual consolation and strength, and the right to preserve and protect worship, and to bring their children into direct contact with valuable ideals. These parents have observed the detrimental effect of the prevailing policies upon the young, how their children are losing the ideals and principles which are the basis of good citizenship in a free world. They therefore desire to restore this right of citizenship and to privately instruct their children against the common pressure of public instruction. Thus, in almost every bracket of life, the public way is antagonistic to the private conviction of the citizen. He meets this by strengthening his own position, and in union there is strength. Therefore, he unites with others of his kind in a protective alliance, reestablishing the ancient ceremonies of initiation in order to protect himself against the possibility of treason. It is impossible to say at the present time how many persons are actually involved in such societies. We see the different types appearing in a fleeting manner in our own country, and there is scarcely a male that comes into the office which doesn't have some kind of advertising or publicity, even here, relating to organizations rising up or continuing for various purposes, either benevolent or not benevolent. Sometimes the society is a distinctly unpleasant entity, one which is created simply to preserve bigotry or to protect tyranny of some kind. On the whole, however, particularly where the need is great, the society is benevolent. It is only in a secure civilization that societies can afford to bicker and can afford to establish unhealthy programs. In your oppressed areas, there is neither inclination nor time for such extravagances. Out of all of this thinking, then comes the archetypal fact resting in ourselves of the importance of the individual maintaining certain individuality, even where a civilization is comparatively adequate. I think that the great struggle of the secret society today follows the secret impulse of man himself, and that is the impulse to be oneself against what appears to be a majority pressure. Today, the person struggling to keep his values finds that for many reasons these values are continually being undermined. Here in the West, the preservation of value is possible, inasmuch as we have freedom of assembly and freedom of worship. But some way, as in other times, we are not convinced that all of the advantages that we have are best suited to our needs, or that we are making the best possible use of our various advantages. There are many devout persons who are not entirely satisfied with the theological opportunities offered by community worship. There are many deep and profound scholars who are not satisfied with the present pattern of our educational system. These and other dissatisfactions lead persons to various endeavors. They lead educators of a liberal mind to create new schools in order to bring this education to the people. They invite the formation of new religious groups to emphasize what is regarded as neglected spirituality. There is also the continuance of your political and your labor organization for various purposes, some of which are due and proper, some of which are oppressive and excessive. But these things arising in a free assembly ultimately solve themselves. But in other areas, they will not solve themselves, because such opportunities are not given. Each person finds in the course of his years the tremendous pressures which are against his ability to do those things which he regards as essentially right and proper. For instance, today we have a great many persons who strongly resent, as individuals, the business practices imposed upon them in the course of their employment. They are expected to do things and to make compromises with their own principles, which they resent. And as a result of collective wrong policies, the individual is under heavy psychological pressure and tension. There is therefore in this alone a simple answer to a need. The individual's so unhappy, so resentful, will probably ultimately organize. They will force their opinion upon the world by uniting among themselves. And this is your essential pattern for the rise of societies. In a free society of men, these societies wave their flags, have public assembly, and receive broad publicity. In a tyrannical situation, such societies must go underground, must hide themselves, and seek to gather numerical or political strength in order that they may ultimately overwhelm the tyranny that opposes them. This concept does remain as an important consideration. There is one other point which I think we should also bear in mind as we analyze societies of this nature, namely the belief that was held and is held in many parts of the world that behind and beyond all of this confusion that we know, there is an archetypal social pattern. And a good example of this would be found by the contemplation of Eastern and Near Eastern religious philosophy. Among both your Far Asiatics and your Near Asiatics, there is the common belief that above and beyond the ordinary governments, the ordinary leaderships, and the more traditional secret societies, there are in the world certain groups that have functioned and existed in complete secrecy over vast periods of time. That these secret societies have not ceased, but continue to exercise a powerful directive upon humanity. This, in turn, strikes a deep and responsive root in the psychological life of the individual. It is only another way by which he says there is a purpose. There is a plan. There is a broad wall of protection around the activities of mortals whereby they cannot destroy themselves or injure themselves beyond the possibility of reasonable remedy. Psychologically, this concept has always existed. Factually, it is to be found in many places. It is not easy for us to accept such an idea, perhaps, but if you are on the caravan trail out of Samarkand or some place of that nature, and you sit down with the native peoples, with the men of the desert, who live in their own strange, distant region, facing the immediate problems of life as we do not have to face them anymore. And you hear what they say, and you think with them. You suddenly perceive, as it were, a world of overtones, real to these people. And after you have discussed with them, these overtones become strangely real to you because you have been moved out of the simple security of your own way of life into another pattern. I think we may safely say that half of the people of the earth today believe that between God as a supreme principle and man, as the projection of that principle into society, that between these there are intermediaries, that there are always in the world certain God-enlightened prophets, certain great teachers, wise ones, as mentioned in the scriptures of every people, including the Christian scriptures, that this world is not suspended in a void, that we are not left without certain resources, and that if we wish to regard these resources as arising from an archetypal government within ourselves, then psychologically there is at the root of us a tremendous archetypal fraternity, a fraternity of purposes by which individuals are bound together at their sources, even though they are widely diversified and divided in their developments and in the periphery of their existences. The existence of this over kind of government is man's way of symbolically stating that he believes in law, that he believes in order, that all the divine principles operating in nature are substantially invisible in themselves and visible only in their consequences. Yet these invisible principles are continuously conspiring and conspiring with evidence of rational directive toward the improvement of man and the protection of those values which man has come to regard as indispensable. It is only a step, therefore, to consider a kind of hierarchy, a kind of overgroup, bound together by true knowledge, bound together by a common possession of realities, that this group forms some kind of a formal or informal structure, a structure which man most rapidly apperceives by retiring into his own nature and perceiving at the root of himself cosmos and structure rather than chaos and disorder. That most religions have from the beginning taught the realities of such prophets, such patriarchs, and have indicated that behind the general government of man, there is an invisible government of principles. These principles administered by beings of some nature or kind, and that these beings form together the sacred and supreme government of the world. In Asia, this is commonly believed. In the Near East, it is held as a certainty. And many Western peoples have become profoundly sympathetic to such an idea. Your psychologist will take the attitude that this is merely an escape from personal responsibility, that every individual is looking for parents. Every one of us is looking for strength upon which to lean. We all wish to believe in some protection, some protective force, and we are unwilling to look upon community protection as sufficient. We are not willing to look upon our physical, political government as solutional, for the reason that in our serious contemplation, we are unable to justify that the leadership which we immediately recognize is adequate for our ultimate needs. Under these thoughts and conditions, we naturally turn, as man has from the beginning, in the direction of faith. Faith being in reality our conviction of the reality of certain substance which we do not see, and yet without which life is meaningless. We look into ourselves. We cannot see our own life. Yet by this life we live, and from it is suspended all that we do. We cannot see our thought. Yet by this thought we become reasonable beings. We cannot see the life that nourishes things, but we behold them to be nourished. Thus we cannot entirely overcome the belief that there resides in invisibles principles, powers, energies, and for that matter, rationalisms, which are not apparent immediately in themselves, but the reality of which we must accept in order to preserve our own integrities and rededicate ourselves to those ends which we know to be right. Ancient secret societies worshipped secretly the secret God. They worshipped a concept of a divine power moving continuously into life for the improvement of man. Modern human beings are not quite so convinced of this. Yet in many parts of the world, they have retained the old beliefs and strengthened them and rationalized them, and no amount of culture or westernization has been able to take it from them. Namely, that there is a tremendous preserving force administered intelligently by beings or persons who are party to the ultimate secrets of the divine purpose. That there are those as called God-illumined persons. And this illumination includes the conviction that there is a pattern, and that the laws, principles, and motions of society are governed from a root. And in contemplating this root, man has come to the inevitable conclusion that it is a godly formation, a godly grouping of beings. Such belief is of the mind of Islam. It is of the mind of India. It is of the mind of China. It is the mind of Japan. It is the mind of North Africa. For wherever these peoples go, the belief that there are among them certain saintly beings has never been questioned or doubted. Even among our Western Indians today, the belief in this over-government flourishes in the little desert pueblos. It flourishes also among the various religious sects of the area, both Indian and non-Indian. Everywhere there is the belief of an invisible intercession, a power moving in upon man, and it has been normal to assume that this power is composed of an organization a government over governments, an archetypal government such as Plato expressed in his doctrine of the philosophic elect. That this being conceivable to man means that it is, that it exists. For man cannot imagine or devise out of himself that which is inconsistent with the universal framework in which he functions. So many nations look to this over government with the greatest hope that it will ultimately lead to their liberation, such as the mind of China today, such as the mind of India. For beneath and behind all other allegiances is the allegiance to the great gods that dwell beyond the snowy band of Himavat. These gods are not merely deities alone walking the earth. They are the great gurus, the teachers of teachers, and from them spreads out the great religious educational system of Asia. And this educational system is grounded firmly in the belief in an invisible hierarchy of illumined beings to whom men can aspire and attain and serve if they pass through the necessary trials and testings as in the ancient religious systems. This subject, of course, is highly controversial. But regardless of controversy, let us face it. There are many controversial things that we never question. We never question in our common religious thinking. For example, the forgiveness of sin. Yet this can be a very highly controversial issue. Many millions of people never question the vicarious atonement, although rationally it is impossible to demonstrate. Yet at the same time, they will question another concept that is foreign or strange to them, but no less reasonable. These concepts, therefore, will always be questioned by those to whom the need is not immediate, but to the 400 or 500 million Chinese who are seeking desperately at the present time to preserve themselves as a people against a comparative minority of materialistically trained autocrats. The belief in an infinite justice, infinitely manifesting, and available to them from their ancient religion, their ancient faiths, and personified for them in their sages and teachers. Such beliefs are essential to survival, to the maintenance of a conviction. And this conviction will operate because out of the believing will come the strength to support that belief when practical evidence arises. In the Near East and in North Africa, the same situation prevails. The advent of the promised saint, the coming Messiah, is awaited throughout the Islamic world. The coming of another teacher is their great need. They believe firmly that this teacher will arise from the depths of the great secret assembly which they hold to be sacred. They believe definitely that it will rise out of the spirit and soul of Islam, locked in its mysterious hierarchy of sanctified but invisible teachers. They therefore wait patiently for the coming of their Ahmed, their beloved of all nations. They wait for the coming of the being in whom these attributes will appear. When he comes, Islam rises with him, because Islam is already conditioned for him. Everywhere, therefore, where men have traditions, they have traditions of these visible or invisible organizations. And wherever need arises, they revitalize them and use them as instruments against tyranny. Also in our private lives, we personally have a belief in a secret organization. We have a belief in the secret laws of God, operating visibly in the world, but substantially held in the divine mind, held as something held secret and sacred. And it is because we believe in these laws and believe in their ultimate manifestation to all men that we variously serve and endeavor and carry on the numerous activities of life with a good hope against the perils of the times. And because we have a belief that there is a divine authority behind all human authority, and that this authority operates in the world according to the will of the divine, through instruments selected for that purpose. Because of this, we are able to meet the future with serenity of spirit, whereas those not so believing live in continuously increasing tension and doubt. Thus, the ideas that there are positive and constructive forces continuously operating beneath the surface of society, such ideas help us to continue our own lives in a more constructive and benevolent manner, giving us the continuous assurance that we are laboring in the causes that are right, and that this right will ultimately succeed and will come to the full expression of itself. This is more or less the psychology behind the great religious and philosophical societies of the past. And this is the psychology which, moving from religion, has made political and social progress possible. Therefore, we have a continuing indebtedness to such societies until those times come in which their various noble incentives and purposes are so completely fulfilled that their need no longer remains. And this cannot be until the world is indeed one brotherhood of enlightened persons, working together for common good, preserving each other's rights and privileges as inalienable, and dedicated to common security and world peace. When these things happen, then we will see, as the ancient said, the mysterious temple of the mysteries, born and fashioned in this world, and that our entire way of life will be a sanctuary of divine powers. This was their ancient dream, and it survives to guide, instruct, and inspire us in our modern way of life. Time's up. Well, next Sunday morning, we have chosen a Buddhistic theme.